Good morning, and welcome to Arts Friday on Central Standard. I'm Glenn North, filling in for Gina Kaufman. On today's show, we'll hear about a new arts residency on Troost and meet a local trombonist who tours with Janelle Monae. But first, we'll catch up with local artist Syke Style. He is about to embark on a big project. He'll be doing the mural at the Urban Youth Academy at 18th and Vine, his biggest, most high-profile project to date. We'll talk about how his work and style has developed over the years, from more political art that included raised fists and guns, and how he is working more with clients to put up colorful abstract murals all over town. Good morning, Syke. How are you?
How's it going, Glenn?
I'm doing well.
Good to hear it.
So I do want to talk about the mural, but I thought it might be interesting if you talked a little bit about Urban Youth Academy, what it is, so that our listeners will be in tune with what that is.
Well, right. So it's a combination of Major League Baseball, the Royals, and the city teaming up to provide an urban, I guess, academy for people in the city to learn how to play baseball. I feel like you could learn all the rules, you can learn all of the techniques, and also learn how to be an umpire at this place as well, which is really cool. So there's a brand new building in which is going up right now that I'll be painting on, and four actual baseball fields. One that's more of a softball size field, one that's kind of smaller, and the two other ones I think are pretty much the size of the field at the K.
All right. So that's exciting. And I've heard people talking about it, people who are involved with Urban Youth Academy, and they're saying that they want to use baseball kind of as a carrot, but they'll also be doing a lot of after-school programs and holistic kind of life training skills and things like that. So I'm really excited for you. You know, I was on the selection panel.
Oh, yes.
That helped to decide upon you becoming the person who would do that
work.
Well,
I appreciate it.
Well, yeah. Well, we appreciate you and all the work that you're doing. But talk to us a little bit about why this particular mural is so important.
Well, this means a lot because when I was in high school, I was an intern for like a week with Alexander Austin, and we were painting on the side of some construction fencing. And that was my very first time saying, okay, I'm actually working on a mural with a professional now. And to see this all these years, 20-something years a bit later, come back, and now I'm kind of heading up one of these massive projects, it means a lot to be in that position. Also, to do something for baseball, and really the urban core is great for myself. I was into baseball as a kid growing up, and my dad loves it. And so it's kind of almost a tribute to my dad and my grandfather to be kind of working on a baseball project, since baseball has been such a big sport within my family.
Sure. So it has that personal component.
Definitely.
But I also know that with 18th and Vine being a historic district, that there were a lot of conversations about how the mural would actually be fleshed out in terms of the historical aspects of it. So would you talk a little bit about how that informed, you know, what is actually going to be in or on the mural?
So I didn't want to do something that was a strictly historical, like, you know, from this point to this point. But it does have that kind of vibe to it. I had to make sure to include more youth in it because it's supposed to be colorful. It's supposed to be bright for kids. It's not necessarily like, this is what happened, son. You check this out. But it's got it's got a section of the mural that tributes Satchel Paige in a different way, that tributes to how the children wanted to help him carry his uniform to the stadium to get in free, and they really looked up to the man. And so the idea that this mural is going to have sections in it, parts in it that you could say, oh, that's a good guy right there, you know, building character with the youth or doing, you know, really good work with children. And then it also incorporates, you know, softball and women as well, and some other kind of other countries. And it really does take a little bit of a whole lot. I mean, I spent, you know, a couple months researching this project and was like, oh man, I got to include this and this. And I've been kind of dialing it, you know, back and forth. And I'm actually still working on the design now.
Okay.
So it's not going to change completely, but I'm still tweaking it as we speak. But I feel like it's got a good blend of history with modern aspects of Kansas City baseball.
Right, right. So you were actually able to share with some of us a mock-up, and I'm really excited about how it will eventually come together.
Thanks.
And I know that it's going to be designed so that people can take selfies in front of it and that kind of thing. So it'll be kind of interactive almost.
Oh, always.
Yeah.
My murals have been, you know, lucky enough to be featured in all kinds of news programs, commercials, lots of senior photos and selfies. And so I kind of, you know, gear a lot of my work, you know, in the public space to the, you know, how is this going to interact with folks in their cameras?
Right, right.
And I don't shy away from it because I know that's how it lives on, you know, beyond the times that, you know, it might fade away or get destroyed or get painted over. So there's definitely a few spots in this mural where you're going to be able to line up a whole team and then get a picture, boom, right underneath of the, you know, the center section.
Right, right.
I'm not going to give it away. There's going to be there's going to be areas where you can put yourself in a certain position, maybe 30 feet away from the mural, and then you've got a crown on your head, or you're right next to a KC or something like that. So there's interesting ways to play with the camera angles in this mural. Being 100 feet long, there's lots of stuff to work with. So I'm excited to see where photographers find their niche and how they focus on their characters.
Very cool. You know, for people who may not know, I'm a poet, and I've been fortunate enough to get a lot of commissioned work for public events, different programs. And I know that oftentimes I have to, in a way, put some of my style on the shelf to make sure that the community can engage with the poem that I'm working on. So in terms of you kind of moving away from what you did early in your career to some of the things that are more public and for different clients that have hired you, has that impacted your style in any way?
It has, but at the same time, it really hasn't. It's just allowed that style to flourish. You know, when I was working in Westport for a restaurant, the art director, she asked me, is this your style or is this your corporate style? Mm-hmm. And I just said yes. And then I put my name on the side of the building. So you can go find that.
Right,
one.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about. Uh-huh. So I've been really lucky to have clients come to me and be like, we love how you incorporate your sense of design, color, and shape with our branding. And we'd love you to do that, you know, with us. And so doing that for a gym recently, I was able to put fists in it because it was very, like, you know, motivational. They wanted people to really feel it when they're in the cycling room.
Yeah.
They also love the idea that, you know, their brands has a social call as well. And so they want people to be like, stand up, rise up, and, you know, be who you are, working out, walking by anyway. So I do find that businesses hire me because they say this really resonates with our message as well.
Okay.
And so it's a great way for me to really just collaborate with these businesses and not have to, you know, do anything that's really out of my sense of style unless I'm just basically stepping it up. So I'm like, well, I need to really emphasize these characters now, or I really need to research what a bus looked like in 1935 and figure that out. So there's those kinds of, you know, elements that I'm kind of like stretching to figure out. But the basic style of how I, you know, organize and layer things, I feel like it's, you know, been accepted well.
So now, you remember, like, back in the day, if a hip-hop artist did a rap commercial, it was kind of like, you know, you sold out or whatever. So
yeah, KRS-One with Sprite.
So now that you've gotten this opportunity to work with these businesses and things, okay, so your style has remained intact. But what about just, like, your interaction with other artists in the community? Does it have any impact on your street cred?
Well, I would say the street cred is that if you need a question answered, if you need some feedback on a project, you come to Psych.
Right.
Hey, Psych, I need a stencil for this. Hey, Psych, can you look over this contract for me? I feel like now I've reached a point where I could kind of pass down what I've learned, and people don't like, oh, you sold out, Psych. They're like, man, Psych, you might be able to help me out. And I don't mind helping out, you know, certain fellow artists when it comes down to, you know, learning the business about, you know, dealing with clients or just, you know, hey, don't use that type of paint on this background, because I kind of want to see it grow. I feel like it's kind of a duty to reach back and say, hey, you know, this is a better way to do this, or, you know, your style can apply here, but, you know, don't let that client get away with, you know, doing that to you know? So I don't feel like anyone would question, like, you know, if I sold out, because, you know, really I'm just kind of passing that along to everyone else. So it's like, I'm trying to, you know,
You're sharing the love.
Trying to share the love. Right, but at the same time, you know, I have been able to do three murals this year just for fun.
Okay.
In which I get to, you know, do a Tribe Called Quest quote on a wall and an Assess Crew quote on a wall somewhere else. And so I'm, you know, still looking for those opportunities to just kind of show up and paint some things and be like, there it is. And not necessarily, like, go back and forth with clients on changes.
Well, no, that's very cool. Yeah. You're fortunate in that regard.
Very fortunate. Yeah. I have to admit, very fortunate.
So, want to go back to some of your past work, and correct me if I get it wrong, but like the Angry Zebra series.
Oh, the Angry Zebra, yes.
And so I think that there's still a lot of questions around town about what that really symbolized and what that stood for.
Certainly. Yeah, the Angry Zebra is my spirit animal. So being a biracial guy, my mom is black, my dad's white. Some people would say, well, you get gray. Like, no, I was striped like a zebra.
Right.
And so, you know, people would call you Zebra Kid or, you know, there's lots of other euphemisms for biracial people. And I won't go into all of that. But the idea that that zebra stood 50 feet tall and had a like a kind of gash in the side of it, people were kind of all taken back. Like, well, what's wrong with him? But that gash is kind of like a boxer getting hit. You know, you get one cut and, you know, what Rocky does, he like steps back up, you know. That was the idea that I wanted to convey, an idea that you could still have a wound, but you could still stand tall. Like, you're going to get wounded in your life. You're going to get, you know, setbacks, but you still stand tall.
Right.
And that that zebra chest piece, you know, stood like that for 3 years. So that was cool. But I realized that it was very confusing. People asked if I was, you know, working with PETA or against PETA. They thought I was protesting the circus.
Wow. Yeah.
Somebody thought it was a Disney thing. I was like, nope, nope. And I felt bad because at the time there was a little QR code that you could read the, you know, four paragraph explanation on my website, but it fell off. But yeah, I realized it was kind of a cryptic thing they just have on the side of a building downtown. But I thought it was great, just kind of staring at the, you know, Power and Light District, like watching.
And I appreciate the way you kind of reclaimed what was kind of something that was used to be demeaning, and you reinvented it and changed it into a very powerful symbol.
I was lucky to, you know, deal with, you know, issues of belonging. But I think I had it, you know, a better way. You know, I didn't have it so bad. I had really loving parents and grandparents, extended family that really helped me, you know, feel comfortable in my own skin of who I am.
Right.
And so the Angry Zebra, you know, it kind of embodies maybe the more difficult parts and angry parts of that. But I don't necessarily always want to be that. It's inside me somewhere. But, you know, I had to let it out on the wall. So I don't let it out in public, I guess.
So you had said something earlier about somebody painting over a mural. So the Angry Zebra is no longer there.
That's
right. So how does that feel when you put that kind of energy and work into something and then it gets painted over?
Well, it helps to know that it's temporary before you start painting.
Right.
So I kind of would come by every day, take a look, maybe snap an extra picture. Mm-hmm. And then when I found out who was painting over it, you know, fellow artist Alexander Austin, I was like, okay, that's an OG. I can respect that. There's only certain lists of people that I'd be like, all right, you can paint over my mural. But otherwise, I could have been a little salty, but I understand it's part of it anyway. So, I mean, in the streets, if you're putting up a mural, someone's going to come up and tag next to it. Someone's going to, you know, maybe add a little mustache to your character or booger. And you got to you gotta understand that that's part of the nature of urban street art in the public realm.
Right.
You're going to get people who want to ad lib onto it and things like that, or just maybe completely deface it. So the idea is not to be a jerk to people so people don't want to deface your murals, but then also, you know, understand that, yeah, kids are going to be kids.
Right.
Or, you know, people are going to try to use your mural to make another statement, as we've heard about recently, too.
Yeah. I heard that Scribe was on the show earlier this week and talking about that or at some point. So, yeah, that's, I guess, the risk that you take.
It is a risk you take. But you have to know how to work that. You know, you have to be either prepared to paint back over what you started, fix it, or just, you know, redo it. But the point is not to let it live. If someone defaces it, you don't want the idea that, oh, you could just deface it and that. That's fine.
I got you. Yeah. So just really quickly before we move into our next segment, tell me, is there a dream project that you have for Kansas City? Is there like a wall that you're just like dying to paint?
Oh, man, there's a few. But, you know, what's funny is that I've got a few of those already under my belt. You know, the one on Southwest Boulevard for the Royals was a huge one that I always loved. I think I want some more larger highway projects where you could see it during your commute. And so maybe some of the walls that are off of 35 Highway or off of 70 heading east, you know, definitely some of the stuff off of 71 as well. So you can kind of see it. I mean, I drive down 71 a lot. So I think what I'm looking for in my dream jobs of muraling is definitely highway pieces.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, Glenn.
All right. Syke Style is a Kansas City artist who is working on a mural at the Urban Youth Academy. He also has work in a group show tonight at Mission Taco called Luchador Collabo Mask. Up next on KCUR Central Standard, we'll discuss the Charlotte Street Foundation's pilot program that will explore 18 months of active dialogue about arts and neighborhoods. I'm Glenn North, filling in for Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Thank you. I'm Glenn North, filling in for Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. The Charlotte Street Foundation has started a brand new program, an 18-month artist residency program on Troost. Today we're talking with Selena O'Neill, who is spearheading the program, about how art and artists can collaborate with communities and neighborhoods to achieve shared creative goals. Good morning, Selena.
Good morning, Glenn.
How are you?
Doing great.
Good, good. So why don't we just dive right in with you telling us about the Neighborhood Artist Residency on Troost Avenue.
You bet. Glad to be here. So Charlotte Street Foundation, of course, has been supporting artists for 20 years now, started in 1997 with endeavors to support risk and collaboration through cash grants, studio spaces, and other supportive opportunities for artists throughout Kansas City, Missouri, and through the Greater Kansas City region. One of the Greater Kansas City regions that's most well-known throughout our area and in the nation is Troost Avenue, with plenty of history, a legacy of inequality, and a legacy of inclusion, a legacy of rejuvenation. And now we are trying to be a part of that in a very active way. Great little space at 40th and Troost, used to be a payday loan building, and even before that, a church's chicken, is going to house, we think, approximately six artists who will be using that space to do collaborative arts projects with the input of the immediate community and what's called the Troost Corridor, business owners, churches, neighborhood organizations, social groups, and other artists who are already participating in creative activity all up and down the entire Troost Corridor. So they'll be coming together with these members of the community, taking their creative vision, working together to ask the neighborhood and ask the Troost Corridor members what they would like to see with an arts project that Charlotte Street can support.
Right. So when I've heard you talk about this project before, one of the things that I think is interesting is that it's not as if you all are going into the neighborhood and saying, this is what we're going to do. It's more like an experiment. Let's together find out what happens. So how does that make you feel? Is that a little daunting? Or
I'm glad you reminded me of that. You know, we've had great conversations about this, and that's the point. It's a conversation. It's a dialogue. It's not something that Charlotte Street has done before in this way, and they are taking the steps to find out how to do it. One of the ways that arts organizations can participate with communities is to listen.
Right.
And it's a step that's not always taken when the organization itself has creative vision and wants to pursue expansion or outreach.
Sure.
Or, you know, further their programming. Sometimes there's a little place in between where they can take a moment and ask, how do we do this best? How do we do this in a way that engages the new areas we're coming into? Or how do we take note of what's already happening and enhance and expand and spotlight that? And how do we, as we continue to be creative as entities,
right,
how do we take in new information? How do we take in, you know, a little bit of a vision from the community that's already happening?
Right, right. So a lot of the times I hear conversations about Kansas City being a place where we bring in a lot of outsiders to help us figure things out. So tell us a little bit about your history with Troost, your personal history with Troost.
Sure. I grew up at 36th and Tracy, 37th and Tracy area. I was a member of the St. James Parish, even around the corner of Redemptorist. You know, I 20 years ago with my family bought a house in the Hyde Park district right off of Armour and Troost. Recently, I've also had a studio. I call it recent, but about 5 years ago, time goes by, but had a studio in what's called the Jewel Boxes, old, great nightclub, queer nightclub right on 33rd and Troost. So okay. I was painting up in there.
Uh-huh.
But I've also been up and down Troost on foot, riding the bus at 39th Street, 31st Street intersections.
Yeah.
It's called the Osage Trail Stop. So my history in Troost spans all the way from 31st down to President Gardens.
Okay,
you know, we've all
sure.
been. So this is where I have seen throughout the years creative activity blossoming here. But I'm actually, Glenn, learning about things that I had no idea were going on right along the corridor in the last 10 to 15 years.
Right. So there are all these different emerging arts projects and different developments that are taking place along Troost. And as you had mentioned earlier, I find it heartening because that has been, as you said, historically a dividing line. So now that this positive attention and energy is being placed on the Troost corridor, that really excites me. And I lived off of 30th and Troost at one point. I grew up as a young person right off of Tracy. I'm very glad to see that these things are happening. But with a project like this, what kind of artists are you looking for?
Great. We're looking for artists who have already begun to explore their own creative vision, who have skills and talents in any discipline of art. So we're talking about visual arts, literary, writing, spoken word, performance, dance, theater, digital. You know, so collaborative, what's called hybrid now. There's all kinds of words, new
right,
media,
right,
anything.
Right.
So let's go the whole gamut. If you're an artist who has ever considered working with other artists in a collaborative setting that responds to and engages a community, doesn't always have to have been Troost. Maybe you're from another district or would like to work with a certain population, for instance. It's something you've always wanted to do, but maybe never got the chance. Something you'd always wanted to do, but would like to experiment with it without taking care of the overhead costs
right,
of renting
right,
the building, right.
right?
And all the supplies, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be part of this residency. The supplies are going to be covered. So artists who have been interested in those types of endeavors, but also artists who have never done anything like that before, but really do see that as the next step in their professional arts career. There will be training involved in this residency from Community Arts Training of St. Louis will be collaborating with us. Folks who have had practice in working with community arts for decades. So we will be guided by them. We will also be guided by other experts in this type of work. We have 18 months to generate this type of programming. And so we will be informing the artists about resources and methods, and we will be listening to them and the community about what they think would make a good community arts program.
Right. So there are all these intersections. An artist who's seasoned also would have this opportunity to grow and learn more and
Absolutely.
To collaborate with other artists. And
yes.
I know when I've collaborated with other artists, it really pushes my work in a different direction. So what's going on tomorrow?
We are going to try to talk about this in person. Boy, this is a pilot program, Glenn.
Right.
So, you know, we just leased the building in August. We're working really well with our landlord. We have a great plot, but it needs new windows, a little bit of roof mm-hmm. repair, and so on. So the building is at 40th and Troost, but Hoop Dog Studios at 3308 Troost. Many folks may know about it as the Blue Building, the Obama Building, and Art Studios. We'll be hosting an outreach session with us from 2 to 4:30. So that's at 3308 Troost, right there in the middle of the corridor. We'll be talking about the program, how Charlotte Street has been supportive of artists in other similar programs, you know, with individuals and collaborations. And we'll be talking about the call for entry process and answering as many questions as we can. If it's not raining too hard, we'll walk down the street to 40th
okay.
and take a look at the building.
All right. So that's it. Hoop Dog Studio.
Hoop Dog Studios, right. 3308 Troost Avenue.
Uh-huh.
We have more information on my Facebook page, Selena O'Neill. Friend me. That's great. But we have more information about it at our Charlotte Street.
Right. And so for people, artists who may be listening who won't be able to make it to the open house tomorrow, you all have put out an called for artists, right? And that's so right. Where would they find that information if they haven't yet?
CharlotteStreet.org.
Okay.
So, you know, do the quick Google.
Right, right.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so I'm interested in finding out what kind of response you've gotten from the community so far, because I'm just thinking that there might be some concerns about, you know, I do a lot of work in the 18th and Vine area, and we do see all of these new developments taking place all over town, and this concern about gentrification comes up pretty frequently now.
Yes.
And so I was just wondering how that's going, or how that's playing out in your world as you're trying to make this project a success.
I'm so glad you asked that. Working with Amy Kligman and the rest of the staff at Charlotte Street, Patrick Alexander, Julia Cole, people who have been doing projects with the community for years, when I had some conversations with the staff after I came on in August, we found that there's a need and a welcome to talk about that. So Charlotte Street is 100% aware of the fact that they've been hanging out in 20 years doing arts all over Kansas City, and why Troost? Why now? There's mm-hmm. already stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing is that for 18 months, Glenn, that is something that will be on the table, on the canvas, so
right,
to speak,
right.
in the dance,
right.
in the dialogue. It's something that we'll be talking about over community meals. We'll
mm-hmm.
be having interactions with our immediate hosts, who are the Mannheim Historic District and
right.
the Mannheim Garden Conservancy. People like that will be helping us to engage those topics openly on site. I mean, we'll be right there in the middle of it and talking about this. What I call through, as you said, active dialogue. We'll be
right.
talking about this with activities that the artists will help generate and that the community has asked for. But we'll be talking about it with a creative spirit. We'll be talking about it through arts, because that's all we can do.
Mm-hmm.
We're not a social benefits organization. We're not a political organization.
Right.
We're not a religious organization. We're artists.
Mm-hmm.
So those conversations about, you know, you're an arts funder, you're a grant writer, and you're coming in and doing something in our neighborhood, what's up? Well,
right.
we'll deal with that. And Charlotte
yeah.
Street's been fantastic. I wouldn't have participated in this program if I didn't know that there were open arms to creatively engage, as they say,
mm-hmm.
risk and collaboration.
So then how did that conversation start? How did you become the person that is going to be fortunate enough to spearhead this program?
I think some of it has to do with working with Charlotte Street, with some other initiatives that have popped up throughout the city. They've seen that I have kind of a passion for arts on the fringe. And when fringe, I say fringe, it's not just the style or medium. When I say fringe, I mean the folks who, as Charlotte Street has recognized with this program, folks who have never gone to art school. In
mm-hmm.
fact, they're welcome to apply. We insist that you give it a look. Folks who have never been formally educated, folks who are creating through disability, who are creating through who are taking on the terms of being marginalized, blighted, excluded, the terms that have been applied to us, even the community being labeled as, you know, blighted or
mm-hmm.
in need.
Yes, yes.
So I've always been fascinated by and part of arts, what would we call arts movements
yes.
that are organic, as they say, but are from the people, from the earth. And this is actually a great way, as a fine artist, I'm a painter and performer, a great way for me to learn
right.
about how to do something significant with that passion. We're actually, you know, going to be using a building
mm-hmm.
to explore those issues. We're not just going to be having roundtables and workshops about diversity and inclusion. We're going to actually be in a building doing art, you know, making movement,
right,
making
right.
words, having meals together.
Putting skin in the game.
That's right. Skin
yeah.
in the game.
Right,
and,
right.
Know?
So one of the things that I've noticed just as an observer, you know, Charlotte Street really, you know, has a lot of what they consider to be like cutting edge
yes.
artists. And a lot of, when I think about Charlotte Street, I primarily think about visual art, but I'm hearing you say that this will be a multidisciplinary thing, but in terms of the aesthetic,
yes.
you know, you talked about artists who, you know, are already, you know, established in their careers, who are willing to collaborate. But what about the aesthetic component? Is that going to be a consideration? Would it be, say, an artist who does like realistic kind of art, mm-hmm. you know, representational kind of art, mm-hmm. Who's not necessarily cutting edge, but is really interested in being a part of this program? Is aesthetics, will that play into it at all?
Right. This is a juried process. So the call for entry includes a selection criteria that asks artists to upload their media or their portfolio. So the jury will look at the entire package, will look at the artist's history, vision, and skill and talent, of course. But in this case, risk and collaboration can mean something new to Charlotte Street, perhaps.
Right?
Something new. Maybe it will exhibit itself
right.
in a way that has not been seen before with solo artists or duo artists. Yes, it's
all
great.
Right.
And it is across the disciplines. So I'm glad you reminded folks
yeah.
about that.
So really quickly, what do you, is there any kind of timeline in terms of when the building itself would be accessible? I've driven mm-hmm. by there a couple of times. I've seen some movement, but
right.
when do you all think you'll be ready to open shop?
Well, right now, like I said, they're tidying things up and bringing it to code. We are looking to get artists and by about the end of November, we hope to move in ourselves and do our own sweeping out and painting the walls and so on throughout the month of November. But so in the meantime, you're right. It's right there. You can see it from the street. But the real activity will be hopping throughout 2018. It's an 18-month program. The bulk of the activity will take place in 2018. On the other end will be hopefully manifesting the arts project that the artists come up with in the spring of 2019. And in the early summer, we will spend some time that is dedicated to reflection and assessment, a key component of this residency. Because the artists and the community are engaged with us in a pilot program, this means we need to collect the information, collect
yeah.
feedback, and
debrief.
Take some time. That's
yeah.
right.
You'll figure out what
it's
just
figured
happened.
In. You bet.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Selena. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun.
All
it's
right.
Good
so,
to explore it.
Hop Dog Studio.
Hoop Dog Studio.
Hoop Dog, I'm sorry.
That's right. Hoop Dog Studio is at 3308 Truist, 2 to 4:30 Saturday.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Selena O'Neill is with the Charlotte Street Foundation. Again, the open house will take place tomorrow at Hoop Dog, not Hop Dog Studio, from 2 to 4:30. Check out Charlotte Street's Facebook page for more info. I'm Glenn North in for Gina Kaufman, and KCUR Central Standard will be right back. Welcome back. I'm Glenn North, in for Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. Now it's time to meet Marcus Lewis. He's a jazz trombonist who leads an 18-piece big band, and he also tours with Janelle Monáe. As a kid, he became fascinated by trombones after seeing them in parades. He got into jazz in high school. Now, after touring the world and playing at the White House, he's back in town. What's up, Marcus?
Hey, Glenn.
Good to be here,
man. It's
good to see you,
man.
You
too, man.
It's good to see you.
Yes, sir.
So why don't we start off with just a little bit of background. You're from Georgia, so I'm wondering what brought you to Kansas City originally?
It's an interesting story. Kind of two things came together. I'm originally from Waynesboro, Georgia. It's a little small country town, like two red lights.
I got you.
You know, we just got a Walmart.
Right.
You know,
right,
like
right.
a year.
That's a big
yeah,
deal.
Big deal. And so I was on the road with Janelle a bunch. And so my wife is from Omaha. Mm-hmm. And so she kind of wanted to be closer to her family, but also I had an opportunity to do things here and work with some musicians who I had admired. So she could get home and visit her family right. more. And all I needed is an airport, you know what I mean? And just a rich jazz history and community here. It was a no-brainer.
So, All right. So I'm really glad that you made that decision, because I've enjoyed your music for, it's been about a year now, that first saw you in the Blue Room, and just really appreciated what you're doing. But you got this show coming up, Brass and Bougie, KC's first big band jazz and rap mashup. So tell us a little bit about this show that you're putting on tonight.
Oh, man. So this show, I'm really excited about it. I had the idea to do this actually at the Blue Room, and I was talking to Kadesh. We did a cover of Kendrick Lamar's All Right.
So for folks who may not know, Kadesh Flo's also a trombonist and hip-hop artist, right?
Yeah.
So he's one of the people you'll be collaborating with.
Right.
Okay. All right. So I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, sorry. So I was like, man, I'd love to do, a show with you, like showcasing a more modern approach to big band using hip-hop and collaborating, because it all comes from the same source. So I think you have, like, the purists that are jazz purists that,
right.
you know, they stay in that lane. But I'm like, man, it's really the same source. So, like, let's work together. And then, like, as I'm talking, like, Kemet walks up, you know, and I was
Kemet
like.
Kemet the Phantom.
Yeah, Kemet the Phantom. Sorry.
That's all right.
Kemet the Phantom walks up, another, like, talented young guy. And so I was like, man, it'd be great to, you know, work with you two, you know, and put something together. So they were like, yeah, let's do it. And so we just kind of had a few meetings, stayed in touch with each other, and then, you know, planned it from there.
Okay. So that's going to happen tonight.
Tonight.
Ruins Pub.
Yes, sir.
7:00. Part of all of the First Friday kind of festivities, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things I was really intrigued by when I first heard your music, you know, I'm a pretty eclectic in my music taste, but I definitely love jazz, and I'm a huge hip-hop head. And, you know, you have this big band, and I know when a lot of people hear big band, they kind of think, you know, the stuff my grandparents used to listen to.
Exactly, yeah.
But one of the things that I was able to notice is that there are these kind of a modern flourishes, or there's a contemporary kind of feel to your big band arrangement. So I want to talk a little bit about how you're able to achieve that. But before you answer that, I want to listen to a clip. Now, this is we're going to listen to a song called Facing East.
Okay, yeah.
So while we were listening, I heard you mention really quickly, that's Logan. Are we talking about Logan Richardson?
The Logan Richardson. With a capital T, H-E.
Right. Another one of Kansas City zone, and very internationally known now, jazz saxophonist. So, so listen to that clip. Like I said, I don't think about, the 1930s or 40s. I hear something that sounds very contemporary and modern to my sensibility. So, if you can break it down for the non-musician,
okay,
how do you achieve that?
I grew up listening to a lot of music, so you know, I didn't get into jazz until senior year in high school. Like, I never heard jazz or knew what it was, because from where I grew up, you know, so I grew up listening to pop, you know, all the funk stuff. My parents listened to Motown, you know, all of that, and just like listen to all kinds of music. I think. That's kind of my approach, like a whole, like for lack of a better word, holistic approach musically. Like, it mostly is rooted in jazz, but there's other elements of music. And, you know, I just try to, like, when I compose in music that feels like I'm living now. Right. You know, and like I can always look back and learn from that and hold that tradition, but you know, I want to have the feeling of now, like my experience, you know.
I think that's one of the things that's important. You know, when we talk about this rich heritage that Kansas City has in terms of jazz history and Kansas City being one of the epicenters, to be able to honor that tradition, but to also in some ways move forward. So you've been here how many years now?
4 years.
Okay, so not to sound too critical, but, you know, I worked at the Jazz Museum for a while. I've been involved in the Jazz District and different things that have happened there for the past 20 years, actually. And we've got this rich heritage, but it still seems to me that we're not quite, well, obviously we're not where we were in the 30s and 40s, but I mean, exactly. Like, I guess what I'm asking is, what do you think kind of needs to happen in the jazz community or the different entities that can support jazz music and jazz artists for Kansas City to be able to move into that space again?
Yeah, I think
because we got the talent. I mean, it's abundant.
It's incredible. I mean, talent is incredible here. I think it has to be like, and not forced, but it has to be a part of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the main reasons why I've had this idea to do the show. I have a nonprofit called Future Jazz, and it's dedicated to jazz education for kids.
Okay.
And so we do performances around the city, and it's new, but I'm trying to grow it. But one thing about this Brass and Bougie thing is I want to eventually get this set in front of kids that might not even get to hear live music or don't have the transportation. So we're going to go into the city.
Okay.
And we're going to get sponsors and raise money to get this music in front of people.
Right.
You know, like 13th and Paseo, Charlie Park, you know. That's,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
There's another Charlie Parker over there, for
yeah,
sure. You know what
absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely.
But if they don't get the opportunity or get to see that it's possible,
mm-hmm.
to play music for a living or do anything you want to do for a living, then I think that's important. So if we can get the music back into the culture.
Right.
And it starts with young people.
I totally agree. So you're wanting to kind of nurture this next generation of potential jazz musicians and potential jazz lovers.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's important. That's one of the things that's really been that I've noticed this morning. We talked to Selena O'Neill, an arts advocate.
Yeah.
We talked to Syke Style, who's a muralist, but he's doing work that really engages the community. And that piece is so important. I know that there are some artists who are very private. They create their music or they write or they paint. Kind of, like I said, I don't mean this as a criticism, but however the public engages with it once it's out in the world, that's on the public, but that's not their primary concern. How did that become a concern for you? Because, you know, when we talked earlier, you said one of the things you really wanted to get across is how you want this music to be in the community. And I hear you talking about with the young people, but why is that so important to you?
It's so important for me because I grew up in a very interesting background. I grew up in a small town. My dad was an athlete, so we used to travel on the weekends. So I traveled all around the United States and got to meet a bunch of people. And now since touring with Janelle all over the world, mm-hmm. you know. And I think it's important for people to experience other cultures and other communities so that they can better empathize with them,
yes.
with their struggles.
Yes.
So my whole thing has been always trying to bring people together and interact with each other, and either young or old. Like, I feel like my music can impact a young person, it can impact an old person as well. So I just, you know, I think we can better understand each other if we're all together. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
It makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me. So you mentioned Janelle Monae a couple of times,
yeah.
you know, another one of Kansas City's own. So how did you all meet up?
Okay, so I lived in Atlanta for a while, and I was playing music there, and Janelle is based in Atlanta, even though she's from KC.
Right.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
A friend of mine was her musical director, this guy, Terrence Brown. I was friends with him and doing gigs with him, and I was doing gigs with these two horn players who now play for Bruno Mars,
okay.
James King.
Not a bad gig.
to say the least.
Right.
So we were doing all these gigs, man, around Atlanta, and some of them weren't great. Some of them didn't pay that well. But I was trying to get into the scene,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, you know, and they're like, yeah, man, someday we're going to be playing on the big stages. I'm like, yeah, right. So anyways, Janelle wanted to expand her band because she was about to go on a tour with Prince. And at that time, she had a three-piece band. So she was wanting to add horns and even strings and all that stuff. So Terrence was like, hey, man, Janelle's trying to get a horn player in her band. And she's going to have audition. It'll probably be you and three other people. You know, why don't you come through an audition? And I was like, yeah, for sure. Right. You know, sure. So I met her at that first audition that we had. Before that, I had no interaction with her. Mm-hmm. And she was really, really nice, really focused, you know, and good to be around. So,
and it went from there.
And it went from there. I got the gig.
You've been traveling all over the world. So back to the Brass and Bougie event that'll be taking place tonight. So this is the first time something like that's happened. I've certainly not heard of anything happening like that in Kansas City before. But is this a one-shot deal, or what happens next?
No. So the plan is to do it at least four times a year and at various spots in the city, and particularly once we build it up some in the inner city, for sure.
Okay.
So, but at least four times a year.
Okay, so that's awesome. So once again, I just want to remind people that that's going to be taking place tonight, 7 p.m., Ruins Pub, part of all of the First Friday activities. So tell me, Marcus, like I said, I'm a hip-hop head. I know you're working with Kadesh and Kemet, who are very talented.
Ridiculous.
But in terms of the work that you do, who are some of the hip-hop artists that influence you? I know that you are going to be doing at least one track from Kendrick Lamar. But who are some of the hip hop artists that you kind of find yourself maybe listening to or being influenced by when you're composing?
When I'm composing, I've been listening to a lot of stuff. Of course, Kendrick is, I'm a huge fan of Kendrick, just his lyricism and his just how he's an artist. Andre 3000, from being from Georgia.
Yeah, sure.
You know, Outkast. Yeah. As you put me on the spot, let's see.
Didn't mean to. I just love this conversation.
Of course, you know, all the people like Jay-Z, Nas, you know, Biggie. Pop.
Right.
I'm kind of, you know, more a little bit hip-hop, like, later.
Not, gotcha.
You know, there's new guys. Like, I even like Migos, even though they, you know, it's like.
Right. Well, you borrowed the name from
them. Yeah, yeah. I don't even know why I like it.
For those who may not know, a group called the Migos have a song out that's really popular called Bad and Bougie. And so Marcus kind of flipped it with Brass and Bougie. A little cultural enlightenment there. But, so tell me, before we run out of time, a little bit more about your foundation. You had mentioned that. I just wanted to, you said that you're trying now to do something about getting music to young people.
Oh, man, I think that's so important because I don't even know where I would be right now if it wasn't for music. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't even know that you could be a musician as a career. Like, you know, and then when my time, when I told people, hey, I want to study music in college, they were like, what? Like, what are you? So I want to start this program to get outreach to kids and give them an opportunity to have a creative outlet. You know, we're not trying to make them like the next jazz musician or whatever, but just an outlet for creativity, I think, is important as a kid. So we've been doing this for 3 years now. We partnered with Johnson County Community College, so we've been having it there. And now, hopefully, fingers crossed, as you hear of one the week, we're going to partner with the Climber Center.
Okay.
Over there on 13th and Vine. Yeah.
Okay.
And so hopefully we're going to have a program there, and we're going to provide instruments for the kids that, like, live there so they can just walk right
just
to the
Climber,
you know, and provide instruments, and it'll be completely free. And we want to get them performing around the city and experience that and learn about the culture that's here that they may or may not even know about, you know.
That's a great thing, Marcus. Yeah. So glad that you were able to join us this morning tonight. Brass and Bougie at Ruins Pub at 7 p.m. Thanks again for
being
here.
Thank you, man, for having me.
All right.
It'd be great to get you on the next one.
I hope so. I'm going to hold you to that. Remember you said it.
All right.
Marcus Lewis is a trombone player and band leader here in Kansas City. Brass and Bougie takes place tonight at 7 p.m. at Ruins Pub. You can listen back to anything you've heard on Central Standard at kcur.org/centralstandard. It's the weekend, but you can stay in touch with us on Twitter if you like. We're at KCURCST. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chin, Andrea Tuthope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Glenn North. Have a great weekend. Stick with us for Up to Date, coming up next.